To those of you who are here for the first night, we are now in the Sermon on the Mount, and it must be observed at this time that when Charles Darwin gave us his theory of evolution and the descent of man, this was so powerful, so overwhelming, that when mankind took it to heart and began to see that here was revealed something that man hadn't known, it was also at the same time overlooked that what we were learning about was only the external, the physical man. It's as if you had been given a history of timetables or clocks, and all you got in the history of clocks was the different shapes of the dials or the faces, as if nothing in the inner mechanism had ever happened. Every clock was always the same as it ever had been. And always then, you see, in overlooking the inner, and even in subscribing to the truth of the outer physical man, we completely lost sight of something far more important. We lost sight of spiritual evolution. We lost sight of the prime ingredient of what should be Christianity. Now then, in the Sermon on the Mount, we have seen that we have here a blueprint for inner evolution. We must review it simply to hammer down the points, to have them, to be able to live them. Now then, we see a man going up into a mountain, and we have seen that that is a mountain of light, a mountain of consciousness, in which he rises to a higher consciousness so that he can receive this inner flow from the infinite. And it pours forth as blessed are the poor in spirit. And we have seen the importance of that word poor as being to us a clue that spirit can never end. For once spirit does end in you, that is death. Spirit is life. Spirit must flow without interruption. And you must learn how to let it flow. And as you do, yours is the kingdom of heaven. And that kingdom is not tomorrow or hereafter, but rather is it the fourth dimension of consciousness in which you are enabled to experience the creation of God and not the imitation. Now, this is the first and cornerstone of the Beatitudes, in which we learn that being poor in spirit is really what Paul said when he said, die daily. You must die to the human self, and pray without ceasing would be constantly poor in spirit. Your prayer is simply turning within and letting the Spirit do the work. Now then, after having established the cornerstone of your inner evolution, he proceeds to tell us to mourn, to awaken to the fact that we're dead. Your soul within you, dormant, stagnant, not being used, is virtually dead. Once you're aware of that, you'll begin to mourn. And your mourning will not take the form of grieving, but rather awakening that dormant soul. Awake thou that sleepest, and the Christ will give thee light. And so we begin to open to the dormant soul to raise it from the tomb in which it had been interred. And he tells us how to do it. By meekness, a listening, a sensitivity, a receptivity to the Spirit within. And in this meekness, he tells us, earth will be transformed. As the Spirit flows, as you let the inner become the outer, your evolution won't be as Darwin showed it to be, but rather, it will be an evolving to the divine image and likeness which is your natural state. This inner in evolution becomes the transformation of that which appears to be earth into the realization that you walk on earth in the kingdom of God. And then he tells us, as you do this, as you are innerly listening, not with the outer ear, you'll find that spirit flowing through you will find its own area of activity, and it will put itself in the right place. It will let itself be used righteously, and so you automatically will be in a state of spiritual righteousness. And this will lift you. This will lift you. This spiritual righteousness will give you the quality of mercy. You will learn the art of forgiving. You will be able to see through the faults of others and realize there's less evil in the world than appears to the human mind. You may even find the ultimate truth, that evil does not exist at all. And as you are purified within through this quality of forgiveness, you come into that state of purity called pure at heart, where you have lost the concepts, even the Darwinian concepts, where you have lost all interpretation of the outer physical man. You're as a child again. You're marveling at the beauty, at the absence of all disease, at the absence of all evil. You're seeing with the inner eye. You're looking out at creation and not at the mental recreation, which is called this world. You're seeing the kingdom. You're the pure at heart, and you see God face to face. And now you're ready, through this, to be a peacemaker. You've risen to that state in which you can, within yourself, make peace. You can rise within to the peace that passeth all understanding. And you're not clinging to it with a mind, trying to understand that peace, knowing that the very peace you are finding has lifted you beyond the human mind, into the realm where you are finding divine peace that needs no understanding, divine peace which is the law of harmony and truth unto yourself and your experience. And this is the divine state of peace on earth and goodwill toward man. Now we're ready. We're ready to live the life divine while in the flesh, ready to be persecuted for it. And we must remind ourselves of these words, because as we're rising, ever rising in this consciousness, we know that those around us who cannot understand what we're doing are going to be critical. They're going to be cold. They might even condemn, and they might even persecute. But inasmuch as the outer will persecute you, you're not concerned one bit, because there is now a depth of awareness, and coupled with it, an unshakable spiritual integrity, so that now you cannot turn back. You're unwilling to turn back. You're moving ever onward, still evolving infinitely. And those other persecutions that come at you will be from your own human selfhood. It will persecute you. It will demand things of you. It will tempt you. It will try to tell you to make bread out of stone. It will tell you to jump off a roof to prove that you're the Son of God. These two are the persecutions, those little tempters that will try to make you do something to prove who you are. Now let's see what he says about this. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. In other words, rather than compromise and appease, you are letting spiritual righteousness live itself through you and accepting any form of persecution the world has to throw at you. This is all presuming you've reached that level where to you, spiritual righteousness is more important than human life. theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. And finally, rejoice, be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Now you've risen to that exalted state where people are going to persecute you, as they did the prophets, because you stand for truth. And wherever you stand for truth, you carry a sword. Not because you intend to, but because in order to live by truth, people must change their ways, and they're not willing to. So they're naturally going to throw stones at those who, by their example of truth, in a sense, are saying, why don't you follow me and do likewise? And this is always the warfare between the flesh and the spirit, which we come to expect. Now then, he makes this classic remark. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt have lost its savour, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Now then, he's told us that we're the salt of the earth. You remember that salt in those days was quite an important commodity. The Hebrews used it for food preservation and food purifying. It even was a symbol of purity. You see there, he's speaking to them on terms that a common household awareness is. That salt sea of that day is the Dead Sea now. Salt, in this sense, connotes that spiritual consciousness which is reality. Here we see that unless we are evolving spiritually, we are unsalted. Our salt has lost its savour. We are the divine seed on earth, but a seed must grow. And if a seed does not continue to grow, it is said to be unsalted. Ezekiel, if you recall, was told by the Father to tell Jerusalem, thou art not salted. And Job, I think it was Job, remarked, how can one eat food unless it is salted with salt that has savour? And so all through the Old Testament you see this reference to salt. You see Jesus turning to one of the disciples and saying in Mark, see that ye have salt with one another. In other words, don't turn back. When you move out with each other, be sure you're seeking first the kingdom of heaven within you. And this is being salted. Now, if you recall, in leaving Sodom, Lot's wife turned back, changed into a pillar of salt. In other words, at the moment that she looked back to yesterday's manna, reluctant to give up her old consciousness, reluctant to move on to the new consciousness, she turned back from the new to Sodom, to the old. And in the moment of turning back, she turned into a pillar of salt. The salt lost its savour and became frozen salt, stagnant, sterile, useless, dead. And so when we're told the salt has lost its savour, we're being told that unless the salt is flowing, growing, living, evolving from mansion to mansion, we too have lost our savour, and the penalty is to be trodden under the feet of men. We must continue to grow. Now, this isn't a matter of choice. It ties right up with that first dictum, the poor in spirit alone are blessed, and only the poor in spirit will experience the kingdom of heaven. because their salt has not lost its savour. And so we must always weigh this. If we are unable to move out of the lower consciousness of earth into the higher consciousness of heaven, we too turn into a pillar of salt, salt without savour, and we're those branches that are not bearing fruit, the branches that must be purged. The man who is not salted lives out a normal human existence with a normal amount of good and evil, a normal amount of suffering, and slowly progresses to extinction. The man who is salted instead travels the route of inner evolution. Without salt, we're nothing. We're a branch cut off. But with it, we are one with the Father. Now, this realization of the at-one-ment, this opportunity that comes to us to unite the outer consciousness with the inner in a realization of oneness, is the genuine salt referred to. The oneness in which you and the Father are one, not two, where there's no God and I, but the awareness that God appears as my own being. And in that, you are salted. Now let's leave that for a moment. We'll go on to Ye Are the Light. And this is probably one of the most important passages in all of Scripture and of all nations. I know of nothing more important than the realization of this passage. Ye are the light of the world. Now, it has been grossly overlooked, misunderstood, ignored, but tonight we must take it with us. I looked up light in a metaphysical Bible dictionary, and I was truly shocked. The Old and New Testament is... well, you can hardly turn a page without being told about the Father of lights. And I am the light. Ye are the light of the world. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. This is the very foundation of spiritual teaching. And I just had to write this down for you because this is the definition in this very important mystical, metaphysical dictionary. It says, light is a symbol of intelligence. We cannot affirm too often, I am intelligence, I am the light of the world. Now that tells me that for some reason the meaning of light was omitted from this book. It could be ignorance. It could be plan. I don't know which. But I can find out right next to it all about Levites and Leviticus and Libertines and Libhi and Linus, things I'm not interested in. But light, which the Master said, I am, I can't find out about it. And this book is that thick, and it professes to tell us the meanings, metaphysically, of things in the Bible. It is truly shocking. It's the very heart of this teaching. Now, light, from one standpoint, we know that in those days, light wasn't a very available commodity. There was no Thomas Edison, you didn't have electricity, and you didn't have kerosene lamps. The best you could do was get a little wick and put a match to it. I don't even know if they had matches. You had in those days little lamps. They had little earthen jars, and they filled them with butter, and they dropped these little wicks in it, and they burned the butter. And it's about how they saw at night. And they used to live in 40 or 50 families to a house. And so each little house, each little family had its little earthen jar. Some had candles, some had these jars with butter. And you know how it is, if you're poor, you don't want to burn the butter. So it became very important to have light, and occasionally you'd go to your neighbor and you'd sit with them in their light. But if you had a fight with your neighbor, they weren't very interested in sharing their light with you. And so they would even turn the shade a little way so it wouldn't come into your apartment. They didn't want you to have their light. And then perhaps they would say, well, Jenny down the hall, she's using our light, but she's burning our butter instead of her butter. And so these frictions began to arise. It became so violent at times in their little human vindictiveness that one would pick up a light, a little earthen jar, in a certain corner of the house, which would be shining down in someone else's place, and rather than let them have that light, they'd move it to the other side of the room where the other party couldn't get it. And they would even do that to their own detriment. They'd rather be without the light themselves than share it with their neighbors, if they had particularly been angry with them. And so this was what he was talking about, all on the level of the common man's daily problem. Now that's just the obvious, as we know. Let's read it and see a few other facets here. Ye are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick. And it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And so this was the denominator through which he appealed to them. Don't hide your light from your neighbor. They understood that. Now we go a little deeper. We see an undercurrent here. Ye are the light of the world. You may remember the Hebrews were very reluctant, in fact, adamant. They refused to teach this new dispensation to anyone who didn't first become a Hebrew. He was telling them here, now wait a minute. Let's not keep this into a narrow confine. Ye are the light of the world. You're not confined. And so the pagans that you consider pagans, don't start moving your little lamp away from them. Share it with them. Don't hide your light under a bushel to keep it from the rest of the world. Don't make people become Hebrews to have this light. Share it. As a matter of fact, if you don't, if you wish to hold on to this light for yourself, you're going to end up in darkness, because this is the kind of light that you must share. You must let it flow out of you in order to receive it. Now we're only getting warm. We're only beginning to see how he was using a local way of life to first chastise those within his own group who wanted to restrain the release of the message outside of their very limited sphere. That was his little slap on the wrist to them. But now the real message of light, the great, the eternal, the indestructible, eternal, immortal message of light still hasn't been said. If I were a physicist and I talked to you about light, I'd have to talk about refraction, diffusion, relativity, electromagnetic spectrums, things of that nature. Now that's what the physicist sees when you say light. He sees waves, amplitude, frequency. When you talk to the man on the street, he sees light as a 100-watt bulb, or maybe a headlight of an automobile, or maybe the sun, or the moon, or the stars. I am the light, said Jesus, and he wasn't talking about that kind of light. And he wasn't talking about what the physicist calls light. He was talking about the kind of light that is the very light of life itself. Spiritual light. Now let's begin to see the meaning of spiritual light. Because he didn't only say, I am the light. He said, ye are the light of the world. I think John will help us. John has something here about light. Right at the beginning. Speaking of God, in him was life, and the life was the light of all men. In him was light, life, and the light was the life of all men. Now, the moment we hear that, there should be in us a response saying, God is all life. That life is the light of all men, and the light of God, therefore, must be the life of me. That's a little more than intelligence, I would say. That's a little more than two lines in a metaphysical dictionary. That's your eternal life they're talking about. The light which he is speaking of is the light that you are. Now let's see Jesus before crucifixion as a man, as his disciples saw him, as a man they loved, as a man who had to leave them because they didn't know yet the message he had to give them. He was the light, and they were the light, but they knew it not, and no words could describe what it is. He could say to them all day, you are the light. I am the light. And what would they think of? The kinds of light that men think of. Or maybe inspirational light. But that wasn't the kind of light he was talking of. He had already shown the kind of light he was talking of. Peter, John, James, tell no man what you have seen today until I am resurrected. You have seen the light of my being. You have seen the light of Moses, the light of Elijah. Even then they didn't understand. And now Philip, Peter, Thomas, oh, they love him so dearly. But won't he please show them the Father? Won't he please tell them, what does he mean he must go somewhere and they know the way? And won't he let Peter give his life for him? And while he hears these men, he's been training for almost 3 years. Peter, you know, you think you love me, but you're loving a man. Thomas, you want to know the way? I've been telling you all this time, the light is the way. Philip, you want to know where the Father is? Won't I show him to you? You're looking at him. And so now he's showing us a state of consciousness, which is the state of consciousness of his disciples, which is forcing him to go a step further. The message is far from complete, and there's no other way to give them the message except to be crucified. There's no other way for them to know the meaning of the light except to crucify the form, to walk away from death would not be to show them the meaning of light, to walk away from death would be to end his teaching. But his teaching was to reveal the light. And so now there is a crucifixion and nothing remains visible. Nothing. All there is left now is invisible light that nobody knows is there. And this invisible light reappearing again is seen by human eyes, and it appears to be the form of Jesus. Now you can see what the light is. The light is the life of God. But come back before the crucifixion and see this man walking the hills, and see that the light he was after crucifixion, he was before crucifixion. And watch this light heal a cripple. Watch it heal a blind man. Watch the light do miracles. And you're understanding the meaning of, I am the light. I am the light of God, the life of God. And this light, this life, is doing the miracles. But wait, ye too are the light of God. And this light that you are is quite different than a physical form. This light that I am, which is doing the miracles, is ready to do the miracles through you when you know your identity. For ye are the light of the world as I am. Now then, this was his revelation of the identity of man. Here is the complete universe of mankind walking around as flesh and blood, being told that they are light. Now we're going to have to study then how this happens, that you can be light and appear as flesh and blood, that you can be immaculate light and appear as good and evil flesh and blood, that you can be perfect as your Father in heaven in reality and yet walk the face of earth suffering, pained, wondering who and where and why, what's it all about, and some so unhappy that death to them is a welcome thing. We must see how this could happen. And we have the start now, knowing the identity he revealed to be our identity. This is really the starting point of inner evolution. It never begins until you can say, I am the light of God. This is our pausing moment, and then we'll have a glass of water or so. We'll pick it up after the intermission. This is an article from Washington, which appeared in the local paper here. It says, X-rays from rim of space. Navy rocket astronomers reported yesterday the discovery of powerful X-rays coming from at least one of the quasars, which is the mysterious radio sources in the outermost fringes of the observable universe. And thus they indicated that man has a new link with objects close to the edge of his cosmos, and perhaps intimately involved in the dawn of the universe billions of years ago. Previously, these quasars, which is a short name for quasi-stellar radio sources, have been detectable only by radio waves they emit, or by visible light seen only through the most powerful telescopes. The X-rays were detected by instruments aboard an Araby rocket launched from White Sands, New Mexico, May 17th. These X-rays are coming from a quasar 1.5 billion light years away, which is roughly 9,000 billion miles. You get an idea of the meaning of infinity. Roughly 9,000 billion miles away, and these X-rays are coming now. The scientists said that the discovery, in addition to identifying the most powerful X-ray emitter thus far observed in space, has very wide implications. they told a news conference, the findings give new support to a theory that the entire universe is bathed in a virtual sea of background X-rays. And that theory holds further that the background curtain was generated indirectly from a primeval fireball from which most scientists believe the universe was formed. Now, science keeps fingering this thing, always having new evidence, and the Master told us so simply, ye are the light of the world. How simple. And how many thousand more years are required to come to the understanding of that simple statement of truth without having to peer through telescopes and discover 2,000 years later that he was telling the truth? All there is light. There's nothing else. There's no man, there's no woman, there's no child. There is light. Now let's catch the feeling, the understanding of this light, because when you do, you begin to develop a new consciousness. A consciousness of light is illumination, enlightenment, receiving the light, letting the imprisoned splendor of the light shine forth is the very purpose of living the spiritual life.